Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these folks. Conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we are talking to Brad Prichette. Welcome, Brad, to Zero Hour, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tim.
One of the things that that recently has happened to you, I mean, we were talking about this before the interview, was, you know, sort of risk taking and changing your life and reaching out in new directions, and this whole sort of, you know, plasticity of your brain and how do you get unstuck from, you know, getting into a rut with your work. And you were talking about your MFA and working with Richard Carline, I think, a little bit, and some of the other folks. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, it was kind of interesting because I had been an artist for some time and almost an outsider artist. You know, I had my own studio, right, and I was a designer, and then I became a architectural restoration person and doing a lot of different things, but always felt like something was missing. And so then I read this article in the back of Art in America about Vermont College, you know,
right,
and I know that you went to Goddard, so you know what that's all about. And I thought, wow,
well,
it's
all about basically independent study.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's about low residency. You
right.
go there, they have incredible professors, and you come home and make the work, mm-hmm. and then they pay a professor in your area where you live to be your studio professor,
right,
which is a great deal. And I thought, can I do this, and what is this all going to be about? And, you know, being an artist and having been an artist for some time, I thought, yeah, I can do this. But when I got there and started talking to the professors there, like Steve Kurtz, like Maura Davey, all these people, I thought, oh, my God, I don't understand a
right.
thing they're saying. How am I going to get by?
You know, I'm an art idiot. Oh, no. All these years.
I'm not who I thought I was.
Yeah,
oh,
right.
my God.
I'm not who I thought I was. But that's wonderful, though. That's wonderful. I mean, how many times in our lives should we really do that? You know, I'm not who I thought I was, therefore.
Right.
So, okay. So you got yourself in the position where you're not where you, you know, I'm not who I thought I was, which means, which implies, so what can I be? So what happened?
Well, you have to work at it, and it's the idea of work, and how can you apply these old school ideas of work, which, you know, we think of our great uncles, we think of our grandparents as going to these jobs that were really hard, and they were pounding away at something every day,
yeah.
you know, and I was beginning to really appreciate repetition, and mm-hmm. you can see that in my art, too, but mm-hmm. it's this idea of can we do the same thing every day, like on Carrara painting the date every mm-hmm. day, you know. And I thought, well, you know, I'm going to give this a try. And Steve Kurtz, I was lucky enough to have him.
So you're talking about discipline.
Yeah, and we're talking about everyday activity of doing it, remembering what it took to learn to ride a bicycle, remembering mm-hmm. what it took to become a good artist.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that you're just born with it and
right.
the music's playing
right.
and here I am.
We're
no,
all doing
you,
drugs and having a good time.
Right.
Isn't it a shame
you have
we're
to
all
pound
psychotic?
Away, or, yeah. You have to pound away at it.
I think
like
that's
art.
One of the things because, you know, I hope a lot of people listening to this don't know much about art, but a lot of them do. But one of the things that is a myth out there is that artists are these sort of flaky, spacey, talented people who just sort of drift into their studios and knock this stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
Not the case, huh?
Not always the case, no. Not always the case.
And lucky.
That can come and go, too. That's
yeah.
the trick. It's not
mm-hmm.
It's not just one way.
Yeah.
It's not going to be one way for all of your life,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think a professional artist gets to that point where they learn to turn on the muse. You know, they do what it takes, you know. You make it happen, and you make it happen through repetition.
How do you make it happen? How do you turn on the muse?
I turn on the music.
Well, I was going to say, because
right?
you know, there are these ritualistic things that some artists
yes.
go through. Do you go through that?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Oh, you
go
do?
To my studio.
Sort of warm up, kind of?
I warm up. I turn on the music. I vacuum a little bit.
Yeah.
I move around.
Yeah.
I have my studio clothes I put on. You know, you set your brushes up. I don't know. There's just quite a few
whole
things.
Ritualistic, you know? Process
mm-hmm.
to get that transition, there's this corny thing, you know, that people tell you in business that, you know, if you're going to have a business meeting or something like that, there should be some time between the time that people hit the door and the time, you don't just start with the agenda.
Right.
You know, I mean, they figured that out 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think artists probably figured it out hundreds of years ago, but it is amazing. Every artist I talk to, pretty much, I don't know of any of them that just go in there and, you know, start painting, you know.
How can you?
Yeah.
Right. You've got to set it up. And
why do you think that is? What's that shifting? What are you shifting from and what are you shifting to?
I think you're turning off the daily dialogue that's going on in mm-hmm. your brain. Mm-hmm. And I think during the day, you know, I have an art job. I teach at VCU. I have to think about art all day. But when I go in my studio, I have to turn that off and I have to, you know, let my physical body make it happen versus mm-hmm. thinking about it.
And I think that
turn off the dialogue in your brain that says,
so the intellect,
what is art? What is art? Yeah.
The ego.
All that. And part of turning that off is putting on a certain kind of music that we get inspired by, being there at a certain time of day, because I have these incredible windows in my studio, and uh-huh. the light in my studio is a certain way at a certain time of the day. You know,
so there's certain really times wonderful. Of day that you're better at than others. Like, just like people exercise better at certain times of day, people
yes.
read better at certain times of day, they study better. Are you a morning person? Or are you an afternoon? Or are you an evening person?
Right.
You're saying that impacts your art making
totally.
Also.
Yes, totally. Yeah. And especially, you know, working as a painter and the other things I do, the mm-hmm. light coming in the windows, totally inspirational and totally helps, you know, the work look a certain way. And yeah, so I think you go to the studio, you go through some movements, you get ready, and then it starts happening or not, and you have to be smart enough to move and bend. And
I love the pronoun.
Allow all the things to happen that might happen, and learn to walk away.
It starts happening.
Yeah.
But, you know, what was such a I mean, that almost captures the entire, every artist I've talked to over the last 3 years. You know, so what is it? What do you mean, it starts happening?
Maybe it is why we're doing it, and yeah. maybe there is no word for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you know, I hate to compare it to this because it's such connotations, but it is, in a sense, a spiritual experience.
Well, that's why I like to talk about ritual. You know, mm-hmm. Walter Benjamin talked about art being a ritual function. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that ritual means all the time lighting a fire and dancing or whatever. I think your ritual can be something more like a drum beat. It can just be a steady movement.
Well, let's talk about that, because you quoted, there's a quote from him that I saw on your information, and it had to do with urban renewal. And you said, and I'm gonna ask you to explain this, but urban renewal is a series of painting pieces on mounted paper hung together to form one art piece created from discarded paintings, paintings in a state of decay, paintings saved from a fire. The work is a continuum of my series entitled Ritual Function, after a theory by Walter Benjamin. And if I have this correct, it is significant that the existence of the work of art with reference to its aura is never entirely separated from its ritual function. Now, when I read that, right, mm-hmm. I'm kind of reading that going, wow, art speak, man. I don't. And you can get up and walk out if you like.
No, but it's okay.
I'm kind of going, I'm sorry, what does that mean? And as I said, part of the show is to help people sort of get past that,
right.
And just sort of, you know, allow them to sort of bathe themselves in art and not think you really mm-hmm. have to. It's not all about this kind of language, but what does that mean to you? What were you trying to do in urban renewal, and what was that Walter Benjamin quote? How did that make that happen for you?
I think Walter Benjamin was really special because he's the unsung hero that died during World War II. You know, trying
really?
To get away from the Nazis. He was a French Jewish person. And he had a lot of theories that were basically against what was going on during that time, and he was having to flee a lot. Mm-hmm. And he definitely is a hero to a lot of artists. He is a literary theorist, and what happened, especially during that time, is the visual arts took over a lot of literary theory, and that's mm-hmm. why there's a crossover now.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, that that line is a little bit less of art theory and a little bit more gutsy. You know, it talks about things like aura.
What does it mean
ritual.
To you? Yeah, I mean, do you want me to read it again? Or?
No, you don't have to. I've read it quite a few times.
Okay.
It means that sometimes our repetitive actions during the day, even though we think they're mundane, are our ritual, and we need to respect that, mm-hmm. and we can use that. You know, so just like you and I were talking about earlier, what does an artist do when they go into their studio,
right.
wherever their studio may be? Mm-hmm. You know, what are the first movements that they take? And are those the same every time? Mm-hmm. You know, do those get us ready? And I like to take that idea into the art. You know, so I did this one piece called The Everyday Act of Existence with my dog. Mm-hmm. And I decided that every day we do these things, and where is art separated from our daily life? So I did photo documentation of me throwing the stick mm-hmm. for my rescue shepherd every mm-hmm. day, which mm-hmm. you have to do because he has way too much energy,
right?
And I was sort of like, I had this new job. I was coming home. I was burnt out, mm-hmm. wasn't able to make art. But I noticed I was doing this thing every day. And like I said, like so many artists from the modernist era, they were also doing these things. You know, mm-hmm. they were doing formalist paintings,
right.
and they were replicating form, and that's what minimalism came from. And I have a lot of respect for that. And I think that in some way, some of these high art concepts are actually ancient. You know, mm-hmm. they're ritual. They're about the true aura of what art is.
So art comes out of ritual?
I think art is ritual.
Okay, that's
interesting. I think it's a movement that you do that is mm-hmm. very much like ritual. And it, no matter, you know, what you're doing, it's speaking indirectly of something deeper, let's say.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All
and
right.
That is that something.
So
that
that's what you mean by ritual. The ritual looks like on the surface, just looks like, mm-hmm. but basically, there's very deep connections to the culture, to your life, to whatever.
Right. It's okay. sort of symbolic of okay. something else.
So, does Urban Renewal, which is the collection of discarded and painting old paintings and that kind mm-hmm. of thing, how does that fit into that?
Well, I decided I wanted to do replications on a small scale.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this idea. I wasn't sure of the number, but numbers start just coming to me. So I started off with 9 5x7 pieces of paper. And I was really interested in some of these old pieces I had just around the studio that didn't really mean that much to me. Some of them were burnt because my studio caught on fire back
really?
In, let's see, October of 97.
Yeah.
So I had some of those pieces and things I'd just been holding on to. And I'm really into the idea of regeneration and taking things and turning them into something new or decay.
Mm-hmm.
Very much
mm-hmm.
into movement, mm-hmm. even within the painting. And that's what mm-hmm. the bio art's all about. So I took these pieces, cut them up, started collaging them a little bit, made 9 5x7s, and just started painting on them because
right.
the inspiration for the painting comes from these earth art movements that I do, like the walking through the alleyways that I did for my thesis show, the throwing the stick for my dog, and mm-hmm. even the sightseer stuff where I put mm-hmm. installations up and down the East Coast. That's part of the inspiration that I'm also talking about, that being the art. So I bring that into Urban Renewal, and I'm replicating 9 pieces, and they're all the same. There's no one subject. So that these 9 pieces are together on the wall as a grid, and they're one piece.
Right.
They're not different pieces.
Right.
This is a grid that's meant to be one piece.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to this idea of the drum beat, you know, the movement, that everything's equal. It's not this, hey, look at this wonderful painting and look at this huge subject matter in my painting and isn't it wonderful and aren't I wonderful, and I'm just not part of that anymore. You know, I
mm-hmm.
want it sort of spread out. I want people to look at the piece like Urban Renewal and see all the different things and see that they are all the same, that they create this rhythm, you know, this movement.
So it sounds like one of the things that's important for you is getting away from the preconceived art idea, getting away from the ego, and creating something that's sort of transcendent of that?
Yes.
Is that
Yeah, and I think that's something that happened at Vermont College too. Yeah. You know, and I think where I was interested in making some changes, and of course, I mean, that's why you make this decision and you go to get your MFA and you want to learn new things, mm-hmm. you know. And I was interested in making this transition into another way of approaching painting, you know. But what I found out was that my painting style and my interest didn't need to change, you mm-hmm. know. Mm-hmm. And, well, I mean, really, the painting didn't need to change at all. But what I learned was this idea, like, what is this concern with painting, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, challenged a lot with its reference to colonialism, commodity, all these different things, you know, that painting represents this. And mm-hmm. I started thinking, mm-hmm. but it doesn't have to. There's something incredibly beautiful and ritualistic about painting, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's why I've been working with these ideas of removing the subject, mm-hmm. but still having the painting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, when you say commercially, you're talking about that thing I've talked about on the show a bunch of times of, you know, the whole pressure. I mean, obviously, someone who does work for themselves, possibly for the viewer. But there's also this huge thing that happens if their work starts selling, mm-hmm. you know, and but then that creates a whole new reality for the work to exist in, which is the work now becomes a commodity.
Yes.
And so the artist has to fight, am I in the commodity business? Am I still able to make art? What if I change my art and it doesn't sell any? I mean, it's all that, you know, the way a capitalist society looks at art is it's good if it's worth $300,000.
You're a successful artist.
If you're a successful, so you know, what makes you a successful artist?
I think my eclectic approach to what art is makes me a successful artist. I think that I'm able to make a living mm-hmm. with a job, with a profession in the arts, mm-hmm. and I'm able to make the art that I want to make, and I'm able to make these statements, and I'm also able to change my art up as I move. You know, I'm not reliant on any one patron, you know, that is supporting
me. So it feels
me.
Very rich to you? Feels very, I mean, it resonates. This is what I should be doing.
I work with a lot of freshman art students mm-hmm. at VCU, mm-hmm. and that's fulfilling. Mm-hmm. Teaching art is fulfilling, and making the art I want to make is all fulfilling.
Yeah.
You know, working at 1708.
Right.
It's wonderful. It's the mixture.
It's wonderful. Well, let's just take a break here for a second. We're talking to Brad Bruchette, and I looked at your resume, which I thought was interesting. It says gender male, astrological sign Pluto. No, not really. Aries, industry, environment. Do you have a job in the environmental industry?
Well, that's my art.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think that comes from my blog site, the resume that you're reading.
Occupation artist, location on the border, southeast United States. About me, Luca Dog is crazy. So you're a teacher, an artist, someone who's obviously realized that it's important to continue learning, changing, challenging yourself, challenging your art. I think one of the people that you worked with who probably might have been as well known as anybody in this town who might have had a huge impact on you was Richard Carline. What was it like working with Richard?
Wow. I think wow explains it.
Okay, next question.
Well, I knew who Richard was. I had brushed by him many times, but I'd never had a full conversation with him. Mm-hmm. And when I was searching for a studio professor through Vermont College, his name came up a couple times. I think even your wife brought his name up.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, my God, but this man is so great. Yeah. How can I approach him?
Yeah.
And I did. I just got the nerve up, and I approached him, and he considered it. I couldn't believe it. And then when we started working together, we found out that we had this incredible connection.
Yeah.
And it was our eclectic backgrounds. He had mm-hmm. started out as a dancer.
I know.
You know, and went into the army.
Yeah.
And even at VCU, they weren't sure where to put him.
I didn't know Richard.
He was in the sculpture department, the painting department.
Richard was in the army. That's great.
Yeah.
And for those of you who don't know what we're talking about Richard Carline. I taught at VCU for over 30 years. Won numerous awards for his teaching. Won the award from the biggest award they can give you at VCU.
The presidential award for teaching excellence.
Yeah.
I believe.
Won national awards for that. I don't think there was a person that Richard. He was one of those people mm-hmm. who could talk to you for 10 minutes and you'd never forget him.
Oh God!
He could just reach inside of you. Just a tremendous, tremendous human being. Died, I guess, 2 years ago now.
Yeah.
Gosh, has it really been 2 years?
Yeah. It was interesting because I was Richard's last student, I guess. Mm-hmm. And he taught me so much. And one thing he taught me was how to teach without teaching. Richard didn't teach. He talked to you, mm-hmm. and he did something. He mesmerized you. Mm-hmm. And he allowed you to open the door. And what a gift for you to open the door yourself and not have somebody who thinks they're a great teacher just blasting out things at you. Mm-hmm. You know, Richard knew how to pause and he knew how to listen, mm-hmm. you know, and he knew how to be interested in what you're interested in and connect it with something that he knew about.
He was one of the most selfless people I ever met.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, he really would listen. His ability to listen was astounding.
And he was funny.
And he loved people.
Yeah.
You know, so that's you can't fake that one.
And
he was funny.
He knew John Cage.
Yes, I know.
Yeah.
And he was amazingly humble.
Yeah.
He was amazingly humble. Anyway, so I'm glad that you had that opportunity. And that's a wonderful thing to say about teaching, because teaching is not only about sharing information. Teaching is about helping someone to discover for themselves. I mean, that's the best part of teaching. You know, when someone gets to that place.
It's about letting down your own guard.
Yeah.
And in a way, it goes back to some of the approaches to art that you and I were talking about earlier. Mm. It's about letting go of that ego and allowing the person or persons in front of you to excel.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. It's almost more guiding, I guess.
Yeah.
Than here's, you know, I think the biggest mistake, and we've all done it, we've taught, but, you know, here's the information, here's the answer. You know, so sad.
Now repeat that in 10 days and you may get an A if you come to class every day.
Right. And some of that's important, right? You know, how do you learn to play the violin unless somebody teaches you how to, you know, play the chords and, you know, as you were talking about ritual and
repetition.
You know, repetition and, you know, and all that stuff is important, but it ain't the end game.
No,
it's not.
And that's
the
beauty of art and teaching art.
Well, Sightseer, that was, talk about that a little bit, because that, I saw that on your blog, and that was what was interesting about it is there's still black and white photographs, correct?
Yes.
And yet, I read it, until you mentioned it to me, I read it as a video.
Well, I just
which is just
changed it
amazing.
Into a video. I took these black and white images
and went on
Movie Maker and just blended them one to the next.
Okay, so what are they though? I mean,
they're
tell who's listening, because they have no idea that you and I are sitting here.
Okay, cool.
Buck naked in front of a totem pole. So we have to tell them these things.
And all these people around us.
Yes,
are,
and all these blind people we've invited in to watch the show.
Okay. Well, it's really interesting because I had Dick Carline as a professor, and something really strange happened to me right in the middle of my career at Vermont College, getting my MFA program, was that my mom passed away right in the dead center.
Wow.
And it sort of like made me drop all the stuff and really think about what is art and about the inspiration. And so for me, the inspiration had always come from this movement through nature and moving in a way that you don't know what the next movement is, mm-hmm. creating your own path, walking aimlessly through the woods. Mm-hmm. And Dick Carline picked up on that a lot, and he was a big promoter of it. So when I came back from that residency...
So a journey not knowing, a not knowing kind of journey.
Just the journey with no end.
Okay.
There's really no ending
okay.
to it. And when I came back from that residency and told Dick Carline what my ideas were, he was just astounded. He was all about it. So mm-hmm. he and I worked together, and I'd been painting, and I decided for one semester I just wasn't going to paint, and I was going to do this intervention into the environment. And I had taken some visual aesthetics from stories told to me by my mom and my aunts and places they had been that were just so exotic growing up, like Niagara Falls. Like when you're 6 years old, like that's in another country.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah,
right. You know? Yeah. And so, I decided that I would pick four or five places and, put this installation up, which consisted of, a antique dress, an antique bowl.
Antique white dresses.
Yeah.
Was it white? Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Well, a lot of dresses from back in the 30s and 40s were just these really simple white dresses. Mm-hmm. So I went around to places like Bygones and thrift stores and collected five incredible dresses. I went around and collected bowls, really simple bowls, and I would fill the bowls up with three apples. And then also this other thing I'd been doing for quite some time, which is gleaning trash cans from cemeteries, which is an interesting story because growing up in the South, I would go with my aunts and my mom to cemeteries and take the used flowers out of the trash cans. And these ladies would go back and refurbish them and paint them. And on Easter, those flowers would go back to our, you know, our ancestors' graves. You know?
Really?
And after talking with another teacher, Kendall Buster, who's actually from Georgia, the weird thing was is that her mom did the same thing.
What, are these plastic flowers?
Yeah, back then they were. Now they're silk.
Okay.
And so
okay.
I decided to, like, replicate this action a bit in memory of my mom. And so I would go to cemeteries with friends and start walking. And when I would see grave sites that were in disarray or something, I would pick up the flowers around them and fix them, you know, sort of as a karmic passing. And then I would go to the trash cans. I wouldn't take flowers off of the graves, but I'd go to the trash cans and pull the ones I thought were interesting out and save bags and bags of these. And then in Sightseer, there was the dress, there's the bowl of the apples, and then I would plant three roses that I had gleaned from these trash cans. And that was all there was to the installation, except the installation repeats. It's a ritual. Mm-hmm. It happens over and over again. So there was one up around Niagara. I actually, because there was an orange alert that day, I couldn't go down to the river on the United States side.
Afraid you're going to blow up Niagara Falls,
no,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm very subversive.
Yeah.
And my wife and I, yeah, with our backpacks, who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows? If they would have looked in there and seen dresses.
Never would have thought of
flowers.
Blowing up Niagara Falls, but especially with dresses and flowers. But you never know about these terrorists.
Only fishing and boating allowed.
No,
and I'm
dress
like,
hanging.
Oh my God, they're going to arrest me because I'm making art. I'm not following the rules.
No art allowed.
And this is, you know, during the Orange Alert times. What is the government going to do to me for making art, you know? And
we've got to do this. You and I have to do this. We have got to make signs that say no art allowed.
Yeah,
and take a
no
road
art
trip.
Making
no
here.
Art making here. Well, I'm afraid, unfortunately, we're out of time. That's really fabulous, and I'm sure we could go on for much, much longer.
Good.
And I really, really appreciate you coming in, talking about your work, talking about how you think about your work, some of the impact that just being alive has had on you in terms of how you approach it and how you've changed it and how you've tried to grow and continue to grow. And I want to thank you folks. And I guess I ought to back up just a minute. We're talking to Brad Burchett, who teaches at VCU and is involved in 1708 Gallery and is a maker of eclectic kinds of arts, but primarily a painter. Obviously a photographer, sound artist, I don't know, gosh, you know.
Earth art.
Earth art. You know, we didn't get to the postcard art, but anyway. So, you know, I want to thank you folks for listening. We hope to see you for lunch again on the radio next Friday at 12:30. This is Tim Bowring. You're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM. It's Richmond's Indie Radio, and it's radio for the rest of us.
See you guys later.
Yeah. Thank you, buddy. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.